All right, everybody, here we go again for yet another Tech Doctor podcast. I'm Robert, one of the Tech Doctors, and along with me is my compadre, Allison Hartley. Allison, how are you?
I am doing okay. I am just trying to enjoy day two of a three-day weekend. A podcast always makes that better.
You had Friday off yesterday?
Yeah, it's a state and federal holiday.
Oh, nice. Today, we are very fortunate that we're going to do something a little different, at least format-wise, than what we've done before. We're going to spend the first half of the podcast talking with Shelley Brisbane all about the new addition to iOS Access for All, and the second half talking with Lisa Salinger about a new Apple Watch tutorial. So we got interesting stuff to talk about. Shelley, welcome back to the podcast. It's been a while. Glad to have you. How are you?
I'm well. Thank you, Robert. Thank you, Allison. It's always lovely to talk to you guys. I'm happy to be here.
Usually when you come back, it's because something interesting is going on in Shelley land, and you have an iOS 10 version of your book just out. I sat down this week and read that book, and as always, am constantly amazed with how you keep up, not just with disabilities like visual impairments, but all the disabilities that Apple devices work with. Can you just update us a little bit on what this iOS 10 version of iOS Access for All is all about?
Sure. Well, the subtitle of the book is Your Comprehensive Guide to Accessibility for iPad, iPhone, and iPod Touch. And so what I try to do is cover anything related to accessibility, whether it be for folks with blindness, low vision, motor disabilities, hearing disabilities, or cognitive disabilities. And I organize the book around chapters that cover those topics. And I have just released my fourth edition of that book. The first one was for iOS 7. This is for iOS 10. And the book is structurally as it has been all along, but this version has a lot more stuff because Apple did give us some nice updates, and also there were a few things that just needed a little bit more explication. And then the other thing I did was try to get in a little more how mainstream features can be turned to the benefit of folks with accessibility needs. iOS 10 is a nice update, and so I guess structurally, if you've seen the book before, it'll be familiar to you, but everything has been updated. There's, I think, about 80 pages of new content altogether in the book.
Well, that's excellent. And I saw a lot of new content in there. And I think there is a trend these days, perhaps, of people in the mainstream recommending that their fellow mainstream folks use certain accessibility features to maybe help them see buttons better, or maybe to magnify something, or perhaps to have the voiceover voice read things to them automatically on the screen. I gather you sort of are covering that kind of thing when you talk about that issue.
The joke I always have is that anytime you see an article that says top 10 secret iOS 10 features, most of them are going to be in the accessibility pane in some regard. And what that means is that there are a lot of tools that mainstream folks can get some benefit out of, but that they don't know are useful to them. And I still address people with accessibility needs primarily as the audience for this book. And I've actually considered writing something separate that addresses, say, if you're a person who doesn't have a disability, but you may have an age-related visual change, or you may have a hearing impairment that's come on because of age. Often it's age, or maybe it's sudden disability, but usually it's finding a way to overcome something that has been caused by age. There are a lot of ways people can use an iDevice to assist them with that stuff that's not apparent if you're in the mainstream world. But I do want to stress that what I do in this book, I cover mainstream features that we as people with disabilities can use. But I don't go to the other side and say, hey, if you're a person who doesn't have a disability, this is how you can get the most out of it. I let the secret features of iOS 10 articles cover that, at least for now.
Apple has tried, I think, to make the point that their products are for everyone, which happens to include people with disabilities. And this book, I think, fits well with that idea, because you do cover how to do many things in the book. And if they are specific, for example, to voiceover, you highlight that and tell people, well, this would be the voiceover gesture. But all in all, I'm thrilled to even see Apple at some point moved accessibility into the main part of the general settings area. So I don't know, it just feels like it's more just a part of the operating system.
Yeah, I think we are seeing accessibility definitely coming more into the mainstream, definitely becoming something that more people are talking about, not just on podcasts, but even within Apple. You saw at the beginning of the most recent keynote that the first video was all about accessibility. And I think that it's helping to, quote unquote, normalize disabilities and to show that, hey, these are features that everyone uses in different ways, people with disabilities, people without. I think it's pretty awesome. What I always appreciate about your book, Shelley, is that I learn something every time, even though I usually have been playing with the beta since day one. I find that as a voiceover user, I always learn or remember something as I'm reading through your book. And especially now, I am managing a group of rehabilitation counselors who specialize in helping people with every other disability besides blindness. So I found myself this time around paying attention to the chapters dedicated to the hearing accessibility features and guided access and switch access and a lot of the things that I tried to pay attention to before, but I was more stuck in the blind voiceover bubble. So it was really timely, actually.
Those features are sometimes hard to make a connection to if you don't have the hardware accessories that go with them, say for switch control or hearing aid use. And it is, frankly, a bit of a challenge sometimes for somebody like me who tends to come from the blindness perspective to reach out and figure out not only how those tools work, but how people use them in the real lives. And I've had the opportunity to go to some conferences and talk to some people who actually use those features either with clients or themselves. And it's eye-opening to me, just as it is for somebody who isn't familiar with voiceover, who sees it demonstrated for the first time. And I've really learned a lot in the course of writing this book and toward the end of writing the last version too, for example, about how switch control is used in real life. I can explain to you that a switch is a device you use to perform a gesture that you can't perform with a finger, but that's a whole other thing to see somebody's iPad rigged out with a set of switches that is mapped to their specific needs and that is positioned physically in a way that makes it accessible to them. And so I tried to add a little more sort of use case detail this time around, and I want to do that more in the future. I think the more we dig into the actual details of all of the disability categories, the more I find anyway. I find that Apple has done all this stuff that I'm not even always aware of when I start writing the book, and it's kind of cool once you, I mean, if you're spending your full time during the summer when you're working with the betas, you actually do have the time to sort of go, what does this do and how does it work and how do people actually use it who don't have the same kind of accessibility needs I do?
When you're researching an area like switch control, which I was amazed at the level of detail that you have in the book this time, when you're researching that kind of thing for the book that's not an area that you live and breathe every day, how do you find that information?
Well, there are actually companies that make switches that have put out some fairly good documentation that is focused on how their products pair with iOS. I've also talked to some of the people at those companies when I go to conventions like CSUN or ATIA, because they're often exhibitors and I get to see those devices in action. And there are a few people out there in the world who are trying to let people know how switches work with iOS and macOS. And so it really is a combination of all those things. There's no one source, and it absolutely doesn't come out of my brain. It's the most reported version, part of the book for me, because it's the part I know least about. Low vision stuff is out of my head, and VoiceOver is out of my head and the head of my friends on Twitter to a large degree. But when I'm digging into switch control and touch accommodation, I actually have to listen to a lot of people who know way more than I do about it.
It seems like most of the time when people write one of these type books, they focus on a very narrow area. They stick strictly to use with VoiceOver, or maybe someone, I don't know, has written a book on using iOS devices if you're deaf. I don't know for sure. But you took the opposite approach here. You decided, I'm going to cover all of the disability areas to whatever degree you were able to get good information. And has that worked well for this book? Do you think that people value it because maybe they can use it as a reference, or maybe someone like Allison, who works with people with other disabilities, would want this book or need it more on their bookshelf or in their device, I guess would be more accurate?
I absolutely thought about people in Allison's position when I was putting this book together and earlier versions as well, because somebody who's in a rehab agency situation or maybe in an education situation may be confronted with a client or a student that has a need that they haven't dealt with individually. And if my book is available to them, then they can research it, and they may actually need to learn more. So let's say you have a student or a client who uses switch control. You're going to learn something about the capabilities of switch control from my book, but you're going to have to do more detailed research in terms of finding the products and configurations that are right for the person you're working with. And so I'm going to give you a start, but I feel like having those resources all in one place is going to save you a lot of web searching, and is also just going to make it more possible for you to understand what the iOS capabilities are. Don't forget, I'm not just telling you this is how switch control works, but this is how it works with iOS. So right, it makes people who aren't using it on a daily basis better able to understand what the capabilities of the iPad or the iPhone are, and maybe also helps them make a decision about choosing an Apple product over another product, because there are actual resources out there that they can use to learn how best to deploy it in their environment.
Yeah, and you can use this book, it seems to me, in a couple different ways. You can read everything if you need to or want to and get a good overview, but you can also use it as a reference and just go directly to what you need. And I know I'm always forgetting some of the commands that you can use with a Braille display, and it's very easy look those up in this book.
There are three appendices in the back. There's VoiceOver commands, keyboard commands for if you have an external keyboard attached, and then Braille display commands. And then I put a fourth appendix in because I moved some of the initial iOS configuration stuff into the back of the book, since I think people are having to do that less. So yeah, that's absolutely my goal. And I've had several people ask me if they can buy the appendices on their own, and I'd really rather not do that. I've sold individual I call them chapters with 2P, CHAPPTERS on some of the individual apps that are covered in the book. But I think the appendices, although they're great references, work best when you think about them in the context of the VoiceOver chapter, where I explain to you not only how to connect your Bluetooth keyboard or your Braille display, but some troubleshooting techniques and some of the changes that have been made in iOS 10. And so I know that there are command lists around the web. Those things tend to get out of date. And so what I always do before I do a new version of the book is I go to Apple, and there was a late breaking as it happened, but there was a list of updated Braille commands that I went and got from Apple and adapted to the format that I use in the book. And I think that's helpful to people because there's always a couple of new ones. And no, I have to look them up all the time either. If you asked me what command does what, you'd catch me flat-footed because I don't know, but that's what the appendix is for.
Yeah. It has saved my neck several times because I don't always use a Bluetooth keyboard or a Braille display, but it seems like when I'm doing something, it's usually pretty advanced, and I'm like, oh no, how do I do this again? But then you rescue me.
Good.
There are two formats of the book, as I understand it, an EPUB format and a PDF format. And I've only used the EPUB version, but I was noticing that when I was using it with VoiceStream Reader, that, and maybe this is as much credited to the way VoiceStream Reader handles things, but I was able to do searches. And if I wanted to know a specific thing, like I forgot literally how you go about attaching a file to an email message in iOS. And I was able to search for the word attach or attachment or something like that in VoiceStream and able to come up with that section of the book pretty quickly. Of course, you can also flip through the table of contents because of the way the EPUB is laid out. But I'm guessing it's important for people to realize that it's very searchable. It's very possible to get to a particular section. You must put a lot of work into that.
I do, and also the formatting and structure of the book so that everything is laid out, the headings are nested in such a way that you can easily find them. And let me just tell people who might not have who might not know a lot about the EPUB format. You might have heard of it, but it's familiar to you, more familiar to you than you probably know. The DAISY format is based on the EPUB format. It's the same fundamental structure that EPUB uses. The difference is it's oriented towards spoken content. So if you understand how a DAISY book works, you understand how an EPUB book works. And that's why EPUB books are supported on any DAISY player. Also, EPUB is the same format that Apple's iBooks use, so that if you have consumed and navigated through books that you bought at the iBook store, you'll understand how EPUB works to make it easy not only to search, but to use bookmarking and to nest headings. So chapter 3 has 3 levels of headings underneath, and I take great care to make sure that those headings make sense and the outline is organized and that the names of sections are good, easy for you to understand. And so that's the advantage of the EPUB format. And there are a lot of people out there who ask me what format they should get. And they say, I can't read EPUB. I don't have anything that will read it. And what's true is that you probably do. If you have an iPhone or an iPad, you have an EPUB reader because you have iBooks. You can also use VoiceStream Reader on your computer. You can use QRead on Windows. On the Mac, you can use iBooks. Anything that will read a standard EPUB will support the book. And so you probably have an EPUB reader and don't know about it. There's also an FAQ on my site that makes those suggestions, as well as some accessible plugins for EPUB. So that's always my push to people, is that EPUB is not as daunting as you think it is. However, there are a lot of folks who are familiar with PDF and they understand it. Obviously, my PDF is completely accessible, and all of the images, and there are images in the non-voiceover chapters, are tagged and captioned so that you know what they are. And that PDF is something that some people prefer. And so any app that you have that can read PDF will read that version of the book. And you can search too. You have all those ability. You have those features in PDF, and the table of contents can be used and worked through. I prefer the EPUB, but if you want the PDF version, it's available. And then I also have a link to the iBook store, which, as I said, is the same EPUB that I sell on my website. The only difference is you have the ease of buying through Apple, and I get a few fewer shekels, but that's okay if that's the way you're comfortable. So you can get either EPUB or PDF. I have been surprised, frankly, that both formats are really popular. EPUB is more popular, but there are enough folks that really like the PDF that it's worth doing it for me.
Yeah, I know that you had a very nice and in-depth discussion on formats and self-publishing and those kinds of things with Allison Sheridan on her branch off of the NosillaCast a few weeks ago. I think she calls it Chit Chat Across the Pond.
That was a really fun conversation. And if you want to hear me say how EPUB is a great format for users, but not necessarily a great format for creators like me, that's where I say that. And I'm just, venting a little bit as somebody who's done a lot of work with self-publishing. But if you want to know a little bit about how these books are created, then that's a really good place to start.
And I know you also talked some about the book with Ken Ray on macOS Ken. And I believe you've talked to Chuck Joyner about it as well.
I've been so grateful to all the podcasters and show producers out there who've been kind enough to ask me on. I want to say that conversation I had with Ken Ray, he did a special episode of macOS Ken on a day when he wasn't doing his normal news show. That is one of the best conversations I've been able to have with somebody, not only about the book, but just about other topics, because I think his questions were super insightful and super to the point. It was like he was reading my mind, even though we had only talked for a couple minutes before that conversation. So if you want to know, for example, why I'm an iPod Touch fangirl, then you should go and listen to that conversation.
I mentioned those because it's really nice to see you and this book getting this kind of coverage. And of course, part of the reason is, one, you've done a great job on it. It's a really good book. But two, you bring 20 plus years of experience to writing technical information. And I think that's honestly one of the reasons you were willing to take on this daunting task of trying to include as much about all accessibility features in this book. So it sounds like it's going well so far, and I'm really glad for you.
I appreciate that. I do come at it as from a writer. I am not an accessibility person who wrote a book. I'm a writer who decided that I wanted to write about accessibility. And having written a bunch of books in the mainstream, and frankly, having been schooled by a lot of publishers about how to create a book that is well organized and that's easy for people to follow when they're learning a new task, I felt like that's something unique I can bring as well. Because when I produce a set of steps, or when I add tips or asides or sidebars, all of that is aimed at thinking about people with the book in front of them virtually and trying to learn a task. They're not really interested in my beautiful prose or what I think of the new magnifier feature in the low vision section, which is what I get to talk about on the podcasts. But what they're interested in is learning how to do a specific task. I want to use 3D touch with my Braille display. Can I do that? Where can I do it? I want to attach an attachment to an email message and I'm a VoiceOver user. How do I find it? Hurry up, Shelley, tell me. And that's what I try to do. I try to make it accessible, not only in terms of disability, but accessible in terms of being able to find just the information you need. And it won't hurt my feelings if you don't read all 640 pages. Just read the pages that you need to get your job done.
Well, you do it in a style that is very easy for people to follow. And before we wrap up with talking about the book, I'm intrigued by how you started this out. You kind of suggested, I think, that you like the direction that Apple's going with accessibility in iOS 10. I know you weren't crazy about at least some of the low vision stuff in iOS 7. And so where are we at, in your opinion, after you've researched and studied all this? How's Apple doing with accessibility these days?
Apple continues to make accessibility a priority. Sometimes I think their presentation gets a little ahead of what we experience as the substance of the presentation. And I'm being really specific in my language there, because while I think we have great accessibility tools and Apple continues to be able to surprise me in every release of the operating system, they add something I didn't know I wanted. Because, you know, you do a lot of these interviews and you get the question, well, what hasn't Apple done? And whatever I say, that's usually not the thing that Apple adds. And I'm not complaining there. I'm just saying Apple has the ability, based on a large audience and a lot of people communicating with them, to know what's out there that has not been implemented yet. But sometimes I think what happens, say, with the accessibility presentation that we saw at the beginning of the last town hall announcement, is that people get carried away and believe that accessibility is handled and that it's done and that it's awesome, and they no longer need to think about it because Apple does such a great job of portraying the wonderful accessibility tools they've included. What I wish that they would do a little bit more is, when they're presenting especially new products, find a way, even if they can't demo accessibility features, to mention them and to let us know. Just give us a little hint during those keynotes, even if it's a half a sentence or a clause or a single sentence that says, this touch bar that we've just announced for the MacBook Pro, this Apple Watch, this Apple TV, it's accessible to VoiceOver.
And that would be
people,
nice.
People will take them at their word. And I think more opportunities for people who know about the accessibility features before they are released or at the time of release to come out very quickly and let us know what's out there. Folks like David Woodbridge just buy everything when it's new and then they do a podcast as fast as they can. And we all wait for that because there are times when we don't know how Apple is going to implement accessibility. And the new MacBook Pros are just starting to ship. So how long is it going to be before we get a touch bar focused voiceover focused touch bar demo? I don't know, but I'm sure a lot of us are waiting for that. And I think Apple could help us out a little bit by giving us a little bit more advanced information about what they're doing. But as people always want to point out to me, this is Apple and they don't do it for anybody else. Why should I expect that they would do it for accessibility?
That's well, very true.
Yeah, it is true. As soon as the keynote was over, I immediately called the Apple 800 accessibility number. And I asked the woman that probably from her perspective, unfortunately, answered my call. I asked her, was the touch bar voiceover accessible? And she said, I simply don't know. And she looked up everything she could find in the Apple promotional pages, and there was nothing about it. About 24 hours later, there was a statement saying that the touch bar was voiceover accessible. So I think for a lot of us who were hoping and assuming it probably would be, that was kind of an anxious 24 hours waiting to find out. And it's too bad it's done that way. But you're right. People are saying the same things about why didn't Apple say whether or not they're going to be coming out with new desktops in the spring? Is there going to be a new Mac Pro? And Apple didn't say those things. And so some of those people are anxiously waiting to find out. So I think we live still with an Apple that keeps an awful lot to itself.
What becomes frustrating is if a video had started a town hall that said, this is Apple's great lineup of computers. Isn't the Mac Pro pretty? Isn't the 5K iMac wonderful? We're going to announce laptops. We're not going to talk about the Mac Pro or the iMac. That would have seemed odd, but it's perfectly acceptable to people who don't live in the accessibility universe that Apple would promote accessibility as, I mean, to be honest, as a feel-good matter. Although, I mean, I have said this before, and I believe this, that when people see how accessibility works in real life, like a blind photographer taking a picture using VoiceOver or a film editor who happens to use switch control with the Mac, I believe that something goes off in people's heads, the switch flips, and they understand accessibility not just as a nice to have, but as a way that people use it to be productive in their lives. So I think that's absolutely true. But I also think that there are fairly minor steps that Apple could take, and they did promote the upgrade to their accessibility website. There are things that they can do with the resources that they have at their disposal, both in the keynote and both in their collateral material like their website, where they could do a better, more specific job of explaining how released products, not pre-released products, but stuff that's been released, how specifically accessibility has been implemented when it's a brand new product like the watch, like the TV, like the touch bar.
I agree. There were so many demos of the touch bar, not only to promote it, but I think also to fill time in the keynote. Why
totally.
Not take the 35 seconds or less that it would have taken to say, oh, and by the way, this will work with VoiceOver.
Alice and I really experienced part of what you're saying too last summer at MacStock, where we did a couple of accessibility presentations for the mainstream audience. And I think the people were most surprised by the fact these are people who are independently doing the same things that we're doing, but in a different way to make them accessible. And we didn't really realize that it worked quite like this. I mean, we'd heard of accessibility, we saw the options there, but now we see what it really is. And that was kind of neat for us, honestly.
Well, I still occasionally will talk to somebody about a general technology topic and accessibility will come up and they'll say something and they're not meaning anything by it. It's sort of a throwaway line, but they'll say something like, well, obviously a blind person, you know, can't read an iPhone. And that's not true. And you think, well, don't you know what VoiceOver is? Haven't you heard of it? Who are you talking to after all? But there is a lack of specific understanding or lack of thought, unless there's a person in front of you demonstrating it, what these tools allow us to do. People generally understand that VoiceOver speaks the interface, but I don't think people necessarily think about, I could do my writing in VoiceOver. I can edit my text. I can check my spelling. I can move apps around if my workspace is not arranged the way I'd like to. I can send and receive mail. I can conduct business. I can send my resume to a potential employer. I can take pictures with the camera. The specificity of those things we take for granted, but our sighted colleagues don't always know that that's possible. I just have that brought home to me all the time. And the whole picture is worth a thousand words thing really tends to be true for people who don't live where we do, where we're using these tools every day of our lives, or the people who know us and our friends and loved ones who see how independent we're able to be because of these tools.
I think you just made a very good case for why not only just the people who are listening to this podcast, but for people that they know out there might want to consider going out and grabbing a copy of your book, because people can learn exactly the things that you just talked about by reading iOS Access for All. So if you would, please tell us where to get it, how much it costs, and anything else you think someone might need or want to know if they want to grab a copy of it.
Sure. The book's website is iosaccessbook.com. You can buy the book from me for $20 in EPUB or PDF format, or you can click the iBooks link and buy it for $19.99 at the iBook store. You can also download the free sample chapter if you want to see how I write and how I structure the book. And I purposely made that free sample chapter the one that covers Siri, so that whatever your interaction with your iDevice, you can get a whole bunch of free Siri commands as a bonus for that. The table of contents is on the book. There's a bio of me if you're interested. But I think the table of contents might be a good place for people to start, to just understand the breadth of what accessibility makes possible and how it's organized by Apple and according to the kinds of disabilities that iOS allows you to work with. iosaccessbook.com. You can also follow the book on Twitter at iosaccessbook, or follow me, Shelley, S-H-E-L-L-Y, on Twitter. And I talk about the book a lot.
Thank you, Shelley. We really...
Yeah, thank you so much.
Appreciate you coming on, talking to us about the book. And Allison and I hope all of your staff goes out and gets a copy and learns everything.
Thank you, Allison. Thank you, Robert.
Well, here we go with part two of our podcast for today. And we are delighted to be able to welcome back Lisa Salinger. And Lisa, it's been way too long since you've been on the
Sure
Tech
has.
Doctor podcast. How are you?
I'm doing well. It's always nice to be here. I was trying to think when I was here last, was it as far back as Flexi and the great keyboard showdown?
You mean the one where I lost?
Oh, well, I wasn't thinking of it as that. And in a sense, because they kind of made some changes, we all lost on that score. And
yeah,
I'm not sure we even wanted to go there.
It was fun to do the Flexi yeah. Challenge or whatever we called it back then. But that was a long time ago. And I know that a lot of things have gone on with you, although we haven't talked very much since then. Maybe if you could just update us on what you're doing these days.
I am enjoying the attention deficit disorder lifestyle. And what that means, at least for me, is I get to do a lot of things. If I don't thoroughly enjoy something I'm doing, all I need to do is wait for 2 or 3 minutes, and that will change, because I have the opportunity to work with some wonderful companies and some wonderful students. And so I'm kind of doing freelancing, independent contracting, and really loving the variety of work I'm doing and how it sometimes intersects in fun, odd, and interesting ways. I'm currently working with Blind Alive, who you recently had on a podcast when you talked to Mel. I am also working with Mystic Access. I also work with students, teaching them. I do a lot of iPhone use. I've done other iDevices and computers as well, screen readers and just general computer maintenance.
Busy lady.
Yes, really.
I love it. I truly do. It's fascinating. I get to learn a lot about different things and work with all kinds of interesting people.
And I love the idea that by doing different things, you were joking, but it keeps you interested and keeps you moving forward. I envy that in some ways. I wish I could
yeah.
do so many different things, but I don't have the luxury of doing that right now.
Right.
I'm guessing one of the things that has come out of you being able to do so many different things is you've just recently created and published a comprehensive tutorial on Apple Watch. And that's what we'd love to learn more about and maybe start out with what it is, how it came about, and just tell us a little bit about it, if you will.
I feel like I could talk for hours about this. I loved doing it maybe not the editing so much, although I had generous amounts of help with that. But I loved conceptualizing it and putting it together. Basically, I've worked with Mystic Access, and they are at mysticaccess.com, to produce a tutorial on the Apple Watch. I didn't realize until I was partway through outlining the project that there currently was nothing out there designed for voiceover users. I'll tell you what is out there. And one thing is the Apple Watch manual. And that is pretty good, but it can be a little daunting when you're a new user because you might like everything in voiceover equivalents, and you're not necessarily going to get that. So you do have to do some translation. There are also a number of excellent podcasts produced on the Apple Watch. However, most of those are on Watch OS 1 and Watch OS 2. And to simplify that a little bit, OS is just operating system, and we're currently on Watch OS 3. And I can't say that it was a complete waste of time, but I listened through all of those podcasts I could get my hands on before getting my Apple Watch. And in some cases, I could have saved my time because some things changed quite a lot. Some things were added and others were eliminated altogether. So this really is the first and the only comprehensive resource as of right now for the current operating system of the watch, and all versions of the Apple Watch can run it. And so right now that makes it something that would apply to nearly everyone. I wanted to produce something that would be helpful for people who have an Apple Watch, but you know, that's an investment. It's a chunk of change. When I was in the process of purchasing this, my inner curmudgeon and I had many conversations, usually things along the lines of, I don't even like talking watches. Why am I doing this? I can get a Braille watch for much less. This is a lot of money. Am I even going to use this? And I wanted to try and answer those questions for people because really you can spend $39 to purchase the tutorial. And as I see it, you're ahead of the game either way, because if you listen through it and you hear what the watch can do and you think, you know, this really isn't for me, then you haven't spent a considerably larger amount on an Apple Watch. But if you hear all that it can do and you think you really would like it, you basically have a guided voiceover friendly tour through the Apple Watch.
I couldn't agree more, Lisa. I listened to the tutorial and I think it would do exactly that. I think it would help people make a decision. And it's astounding to me in some ways to realize when you said no one has done anything other than the 40 podcasts that David Woodbridge did, or however how many it was. It was a bunch of them on the original Apple Watch. And he's done a few things on the current Watch OS, but not more than a few. It's really surprising to me that that hasn't been done before now. Allison, you're very wise. Why? Why has no one done this?
I think the main reason is honestly that a lot of folks are still figuring out, as Lisa said, where the watch kind of fits in their lives and if it's something that is needed. And I listened to the tutorial as well, and I think that it is a really great way to help somebody, like you said, pay a little bit and make a really informed decision of, do I want to pay more for this particular device at this time, or not. I think it's still a device that is in some ways looking for its niche. Right now, the niches seem to be largely fitness, which is great. But I think that that's part of the reason why it's not gained as much traction. But it's all the more reason why it's so much more important to have a tutorial like this available for people to be able to make as informed a decision as possible and to find out and learn some of the things that you might not have even known that you could do with your watch. Something as simple as recording a note when you're on the phone. I know I use my phone as my main note taker, but being able to be reminded about just press record, where if I'm on the phone with somebody, you need to take down a confirmation number or something. It just is kind of revolutionary in that way. I think it's really important and really great and very timely that this has come out when it did.
Those of us who bought the original Apple Watch, were we mostly blind techies who were willing to dig in and figure it out? And what about those people who just want a watch and think, well, I might as well choose an Apple Watch because everybody's talking about it and maybe that would be cool to have. But then are they getting what they thought they were getting? Is it more complicated than they thought, or is it going to be easy for them to grasp and understand? And you went through the podcast, Lisa, and then you ultimately decided to take a risk on it. How come?
When the first Apple Watches came out, I wanted one then, but I wasn't sure why I wanted one, which sounds silly. I knew that it was something I really wanted to explore. And I thought, I'm going to wait. I'm going to see what the second generation comes out with. And as I was researching and listening and thinking about the possible uses for an Apple Watch, and I cover these in the tutorial, I fit 3 out of 4 kind of you might want an Apple Watch if criterion. And there are basically 4 kinds of people who use and might want and could benefit from an Apple Watch. The first was kind of a big surprise to me, and that is people with hearing impairments. Because, you know, initially when the Apple Watch came out, it didn't seem like there was going to be anything there for deafblind people because there was no Braille support. But everything is done through the phone, and the taptic feedback has been a great boon for people who are deafblind, can help with GPS navigation, the arrival of incoming messages, knowing when something's done. Before the Apple Watch, if you were setting a timer or waiting for an important message, you either had to wear your phone or have it in your hand to know when the information that you needed had arrived. And this way you can just wear a watch. It's very simple. The second group of people are the techies, people who enjoy the technology, who enjoy playing with it and possibly using it to enhance their lives. As Allison alluded to, another group and a very popular application of the watch has been for health and fitness. So if you want to improve your health, you can. It's pretty funny because from July of 2013 until I got my Apple Watch in October of this year, I had been using a Fitbit. And I thought I was doing pretty well. And I was, because I was walking 10,000 steps a day. But when I started using the Apple Watch, they measure health a little differently. And I found I wasn't really standing enough. I wasn't taking those breaks to stand. And I'm also very lax on this, but I'm working on it, using the Breathe app to stop and just breathe mindfully a few times throughout the day. That's supposed to be very good for pulse and stress levels and things like that overall. So I'm enjoying it for that. The other group of people who really can benefit from the watch, and some people fall into this category more than others, but I think we all do to an extent. And that is people who are prone to falling. When my grandmother was about, I don't know, she was probably late 50s, very good health, you know, no problems, doing just fine. She stood on a high stool to dust a light. And she fell backward off the stool and she crushed a vertebrae in her back. And she was lying on her floor alone for 9 hours until my grandfather got home from work. If the technology had been available at the time, and if she had had an Apple Watch, she could have called for help and she could have been spared a lot of that. I know of people who have replacement joints or artificial joints, or in some cases, situations where joints had to be fused. And if they fall, they're in serious trouble. And so just having the ability to call for help in a situation like that is great. And sure, you can do that with your phone, but you're not wearing your phone. And let's say that, you know, you're at your most vulnerable for a fall in the shower. Well, with the second generation Apple Watch, you can turn on the waterproof feature and you can shower with it. I did it once, and all those years of having dreams about showering with my watch and completely ruining it made that a little bit of a painful experience for me. But if someone is prone to falling, just knowing that they have that possible safety net could very well be worth the purchase price. The watch just makes things so much easier and so much more convenient that it's not in your way, but you can call for help when you need it, if you need it.
I'm really glad you took a moment to talk about those areas, because some of them are things that I really hadn't thought much about until I listened to the tutorial, but it really does broaden the potential audience for the watch, or at least for people to consider it. And I definitely agree of the value of the silent haptic information. I use it all the time at work to alert me to the ending time for appointments and things like that, where you just can't get that information without disturbing someone else unless it is silent and just comes to your wrist. And it's also really nice, I think, the way that Apple has done the haptic feedback, in that it's not terribly jarring or off-putting. It just kind of taps your wrist a little bit and you can check on whatever the information is then, or you can just realize there's something to check on later. And that, to me, gives it value, just in that you don't have to pull your phone out to know that. The tutorial, I was really intrigued to see, one, how you went about organizing it, because I think you organized it in a way that I wouldn't have thought to do. You kind of did it in a way, these are the top things that you're likely to need to know just to get to a place where you're ready to learn more depth and more detail. And so could you just spend a moment just saying a little bit about how you went about conceptualizing and organizing the tutorial, so people have some idea about that?
Well, I've said before of myself, I'm really not that special, you know, and we always hear, you know, you're one of a kind, you're unique. Well, I'm kind of taking the reverse way of looking at that. I'm not that special. So I figure that if I have an unusual way of looking at things, or if this is the method that works for me, chances are there are other people out there who will find that helpful. And I just didn't see the point going through all these inconsequential settings especially if you were an experienced iOS user, when every time you used your watch, it talked like that. It talked slowly. So I tried to go through and concentrate first on the things that would be most useful. I tend, in general, to go very systematically through a thing. But I did jump around a little bit because I thought, you know what? If this is really important and we don't get to it till section 9, people are going to be impatient. They're going to be frustrated. And the other thing is, this tutorial is available in DAISY and in MP3. And this thing was DAISY'd to within an inch of its life. There are lots of little sections, which is really nice, because if you want to know how to do a very specific thing, in general, you're going to be able to find the chapter, and then you can navigate by headings, either in something like VoiceStream or, you know, Victor Reader Stream or your book player, whatever you're using. You can very easily navigate to what you are looking for.
That's what I really appreciated, because one of the great things about these devices is that they have a lot of features. And one of the sometimes frustrating things about these devices is that they have a lot of features and it's impossible to remember everything. So I love the fact that now I have a resource where if I forget how to do something on my watch, I can just go through and find it very quickly.
The other day, somebody asked me a question about how to do something on the watch. And the quickest way for me to find them the answer, because I knew but I had forgotten, was to pull up my tutorial and navigate awesome. To those sections. And I thought, well, they do say the mind is the first thing to go. But really, I mean, I don't think there's any way that your mind can hold all of the information that's out there. But knowing how to access it really helps.
Yeah.
There's no way we can remember all of the things that the watch can do. And I found that it was really possible to flip through the table of contents, flip through the headings, and find a particular thing quickly. And also, I was frankly surprised how good the audio quality is of this tutorial. I thought it'd be really hard to record that tiny watch speaker, but turned out pretty good.
That is in large part due to the expertise of Kim Loftus and Chris Grabowski of Mystic Access, who, as the saying goes, made me sound better than I deserve. One thing I did try to do as well, so that people would not be confused, as both of you know, the only voice that you can use on the watch is Samantha. So we left well enough alone and used the Siri voice, the male Siri voice, for when the iPhone spoke. And that, I hope, made it easier for people to intuitively know where we were and who and what was speaking.
I thought it was easy to tell what was what, even in the setup times where both devices almost were talking to each other as they do, or talking at the same time as they sometimes do when they're passing information back and forth. It was easy to tell. And you know, I know you don't think of yourself as being special, Lisa, but I have to say, I really appreciate and respect the creativity and the quality and the organization that went into this tutorial. This is, when I was listening to it, I kept thinking, this is so Lisa and so awesome. You know, you really did a nice job with it. And I would just encourage people to give it some consideration. If you have any interest in learning what Apple Watch is all about with VoiceOver, I think you cover just about everything in one way or another.
One other really quick diversion, if I may, is that you also kind of got to learn along with me. I said I got my Apple Watch in October, and as I said that, I realized, no, it was the last week of September. So I'm learning it and going through and doing the tutorial. And I remember, for example, starting the tutorial on the phone portion of the watch and thinking, I'm not sure I really even care about this. Because why do I want to have this conversation on my wrist? And when I saw all that it can do, that you could transfer from the watch to the phone, either before you answered or after you answered, as I was learning, I saw the so what, the who cares factors all come together. And so I think it's kind of fun, too, because in a sense, you're learning as I'm learning, not so much that you're hearing me kind of fumble around, but my brain is kind of getting the aha of all of it.
That really makes it exciting and fresh and vibrant. But I do want to highlight the point that when you say you're learning, it's not that you're fumbling around and waiting for you to figure something out as you try to explain it to us. I would be willing to gamble that you learned it slightly before you explained it.
Quite. Really, what I mean is my brain was kind of integrating. It was integrating what I knew with how I would use this. And instead of so what was being substituted was, oh, I get it. This is much cooler than I thought. And so I'm hoping that some of that is what has come through.
Yeah, you shared your excitement with us, your enthusiasm with us. But one of my pet peeves is people who do things and say, we're going to learn it together. And then I don't really learn anything because they're trying so hard to figure it out that it's very confusing. But this tutorial is not like that at all. And Allison, you know, I know you have had mixed feelings about the watch ever since it came out. What kind of response did you have to the tutorial? And I'm not thinking it changed your mind, but how did you feel about it?
Well, I'm still not sure the watch is for me. I'm still not sure that it does enough that I can't already do with my phone, which I usually already have with me. But what I appreciate about you, Lisa, is you are so succinct and clear in your descriptions of how you do things. And it gave me a greater appreciation for how easy and fluid it could be to perform these tasks on the watch if you want to. And so I really liked that. And like I said, I liked rediscovering some of the things that I had honestly maybe forgotten about and being able to go back as I was doing something on my Apple Watch after I had gotten the tutorial, being able to go back and be like, oh yeah, Lisa covers this. So although I'm really still not sure it's for me, it's still a good refresher. Absolutely.
Yeah. And what better way to decide that maybe it isn't for you is to go through this tutorial and hear just what it really is about and how it does
work. I agree.
So I love that about how you approached it and how you presented the information. We are really getting behind encouraging people to purchase this tutorial and take a listen to it. And so how do they do that if they want to?
You can visit www.mysticaccess.com, www.mysticaccess.com, and you can purchase the digital download of the tutorial for $39, and you have the choice of DAISY or MP3. You can download both. Or if you would prefer, you can have it sent to you on an SD card for an additional $10. If you are not especially technically inclined and you would rather order over the phone and speak to an actual person, you can also do that. And you can call Mystic Access. You can call 716-543-3323. And if you would like to speak to me directly, you can put in my extension, which is 502.
Yeah, I think that this is really filling a hole for this product. There needed to be something like this, and I'm glad you just happened to decide to get an Apple Watch and do this thing. So I hope people enjoy it and learn from it as much as I have. And thank you for taking some time to come on the Tech Doctor podcast and talk to us about it.
Yeah, thank you, Lisa. It's always good to have you.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, Allison, if people would like to talk with us about any of this stuff, I think they can email us. Do you know what that address is?
I do. I'd have to pull it out of the cobwebs and the resources of my brain. It is techdoctor@dr-carter.com. That's techdoctor@dr-carter.com.
You nailed it on the first try. All right, ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for hanging with us here. Hope you've enjoyed it half as much as I have. This is Robert, one of the Tech Doctors, saying so long for now.
And this is Allison, the other Tech Doctor, saying bye, everyone.